nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So today I'm going to talk about finite element method for thermal transport. So this is a bit of a change of pace from the last time, but you'll see that we're kind of like leveraging a lot of the same mathematical and numerical tools that we had earlier and then just applying it to new physical problems. And then this will also kind of pave the way for studying electronic transport. So we'll be covering a lot of cool topics, I think. So first I'm going to start just like kind of like catching everybody up on what we did on Monday. And then when we talk about thermal transfer, we'll kind of be giving an overview of convection, conduction, radiative transfer. And then we'll talk about how each of those mechanisms can be modeled, and mainly focusing on the first two. And then we'll kind of touch on this third one, although that gets a little more complicated. So I don't have a lot of notes actually written out because it would probably take too long. And then some error analysis. Okay, so what did we do last time? It was basically developing in detail like three examples for beam propagation method in optics. Okay, so the first was like tunable liquid crystal based photonic crystal fibers. And then we said that while that provides like a pretty substantial amount of tunability due to the anisotropic nature of the individual like liquid crystal elements, then if we want something that has a very, very fast response, like, you know, on the order of gigahertz or even faster, then we need to go to electro-optics. And then we said like that there are several types of electro-optic materials, but we kind of focused in last lecture on the Pockels medium, in which the refractive index shift is proportional to the strength of the electric field, right? And so this only occurs in materials that are non-center symmetric. And the specific material class that we were looking at was like this 4-1 symmetry group, which includes like gallium arsenide. And then we showed applications like for both modulation and for switching. And then we also kind of looked at like what are some of the trade-offs in the design. So depending on what you're looking for, you may want to pick different like design parameters for each of these things, right? And I think in some sense, like what we did last time kind of could be a basis for like when you give your final project, right? Like if you present like a technique and then show the results like step by step, right? Like then that's like a really good opportunity to like kind of leverage tools developed in class. So you don't have to develop new tools, but you kind of apply them to new problems, right? So that's like what is really going to be cool for your final project. Now, of course, if you want to kind of create your own brand new algorithm and you can show that it works fast and that it's competitive with other algorithms out there, then you can do that too. But I think that would be a very high bar to raise for you guys. So I think it's more likely that you'd want to just focus on what is like a cool, interesting application of a technique that we've already learned, right? So you could apply BPM to another problem, or you could work on the thermal problems, or the electronic stuff we'll do later, or perhaps something else, like we'll do finite difference time domain towards the end of the class. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the thermal transport. So I realized that probably none of you are like mechanical engineers by training, and I'm not either, but I'll kind of give you my sense of like what are the three mechanisms of thermal transfer and how can you kind of keep them straight. So convection is basically heat transfer by contact between surface of some solid material in intimate contact with either a gas or a fluid that kind of flows across it, okay? So usually in this scenario, you're treating this kind of as a boundary condition. So like a simple example would be like you heat up an oven in, you heat up a potato in your oven, okay? And then you take it out. Then of course, like air is going to flow over the surface of that potato, start cooling it off, right? And so then that's an example of convective heat transfer when the air cools off your potato. Okay. So another example is conduction. or another mechanism is conduction, right? And so this is actually more like within the bulk of a material. So the classic problem in conduction is you have a solid piece of material, like let's say this table, you heat up one end and then maybe cool off the other. And then you look at like, what is the temperature profile across this whole table, right? And so there it's more like kind of an internal like transport mechanism, which can be through phonons. Ultimately, like phonon is basically like a quantum of heat that propagates through material. And so like all crystals are known to have like certain phonon band structures, which are very analogous to electronic band structures, right? So it's like the set of like energies and wave vectors that are allowed for propagation. And then within phonons, there are usually like two types. There are acoustic phonons, and then there are optical phonons. And then the difference is that acoustic phonons can, in principle, have almost zero energy transfer, but then optical phonons always have a finite energy transfer. And so I think the designation comes from the fact that like acoustic signals are usually like very low frequency, whereas like the optical phonons are much higher frequency. So, I mean, that's like a very rough sense of where what phonons are. Of course, like, you know, if you really want to get into the conduction in detail, then you could actually look at it like from like a quantum mechanical perspective. But today we're not really going to go into the quantum mechanics. We're going to pretty much treat everything semi-classically, right? So that's more of like a mechanical engineering approach, I guess. And then the third transport mechanism, which, like I said, is going to be the hardest to actually model directly in detail, would be like a radiative thermal transfer. Okay. And so then this is like when you heat up a body to a certain temperature and it's in thermal equilibrium, it will be simultaneously emitting photons off the surface and then also receiving them. If it's, you know, in touch with some like transparent or at least translucent medium, right? So this, table, of course, you can't see that it's radiating photons because they're all like well into the infrared, like usually around 10 microns at room temperature. But it is radiating that, and then that's the basis of night vision and so on, right? Because like people are hotter than the table, so then like you have more thermal radiation coming off, and then we'll quantify that a little bit later. Okay, so. All right, so convection, I think, is probably the easiest to understand intuitively, although there's this one thing that's actually a little bit tricky about it. Okay, so like I said, you're basically flowing some kind of gas or fluid over the surface. So usually the heat transfer power per unit area, which we represent as Q, kind of like a thermal flux, is given by the difference in temperatures between kind of the surface and then the fluid medium, T1 minus T2 times some constant H. And then this is often called like Newton's law of cooling, that the, basically the thermal flux and thus the rate of cooling or heating, of course, is proportional to the difference in temperatures. And so then if you integrate this over time, then not surprisingly, you get some sort of like exponential behavior. So if you take that oven, or sorry, take the potato out of the oven, rather, right? Let's say that it starts at 120 degrees Celsius, right? And then it's going to very quickly cool off close to room temperature. So let's say 27°C. Okay. And then the characteristic time over which it cools off is, of course, going to depend heavily on this H and the surface area of the potato, right? So the surface area to volume ratio is very important. Now, what's tricky about convection, in my view, is just figuring out what this H is. Okay. So, like, there's no, like, real clear theory about this that I can find, at least. So basically, to the first approximation, you say that H depends on the materials that you're dealing with. So that's like kind of your starting point for H. So if you're talking about air, then air is usually said to have H between 10 and 100. But then it's not just dependent on the material. It also depends on like the microstructure. Like if the surface here is like very smooth, or if it has like a lot of little ridges, like so that it can radiate heat more quickly. It can also depend on like the environment or like the microenvironment for the fluid flow. So if you think about like the way you design a toaster or an oven, like usually you seal it, right? So that prevents convection from taking heat out of the object, like the potato that you're trying to heat up. Whereas, if you want to have like a very high convective coefficient, then you probably like, put it in a freely flowing, area, right? And so then that can change the convective constant, like a factor of 10, at least going between those two extremes. And, I think there may be even some other factors that I'm not aware of that affect H. So I don't want to claim that I have all the answers on what is H. I think in practice, oftentimes it's just measured in an experiment. So basically assuming that Newton's law of cooling holds, you take the data for temperature as time progresses, and then you basically back out this H constant by fitting it. Okay. So the thing about H is like, it seems to be well established experimentally, but then the theoretical content of this is not totally clear unless anybody is aware of like a good derivation of where does H come from based on first principles. I would actually love to see that, but I haven't seen it. Okay. Okay. And so now I'm going to talk about conduction. I feel like conduction is probably a little bit better understood from a theory standpoint. And like I said before, it's basically a conduction of heat within like a bulk medium, which could oftentimes be like a crystalline medium, but it doesn't have to be, certainly. Like wood is certainly a valid example. And usually the really key law is not actually exactly Newton's law, although you can kind of think it has some similarity to Newton's law. But it's called Fourier's law. And then Fourier's law says that the rate of thermal flow is proportional to the gradient in temperature. Okay, so if you say that this is position, and then this is your temperature, then the point is that your Q is going to be minus K times delta T divided by delta X. Okay. If you look at the discretized version. And then as this delta T and delta X both go to zero, then of course this becomes like K dt dx in 1D. And then in 3D, then of course it just becomes like a gradient expression, right? So hopefully that makes sense. So it's kind of similar to Newton's law of cooling in the sense that delta T is really the most key quantity, but then like also the position is a very important factor here as opposed to time directly. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. And so if you like kind of take that as a given, because I think that's like a very intuitive concept, so it's fairly hard to argue that idea, then you can actually derive this expression down here by insisting that you have to have a conservation of energy, like basically thermal energy in this instance, by kind of writing down the conservation of energy in this form. Okay, so what this is showing is basically that the partial derivative of the thermal energy U with respect to time is going to be basically the any kind of like localized input that's present, which I call L or load, like a thermal load generation, minus the divergence of this Q. Okay, so basically this is capturing kind of like any external loss off to the sides of the box that you're interested in, right? So if you kind of want to visualize this, then you say that this is your box and it has like a thermal content U, where this can also be written as the heat capacity CV times rho, the density times the temperature at which it's held. Okay, so this is assuming that like that CV is a constant overall temperature. So for most materials, that's a pretty reasonable approximation. Now, of course, like if you have studied like Debye's law, then you know at low temperatures, then CV is actually not a constant, but it depends on temperature. But we're just assuming what's called the law of Dulong and Petit, that energy is proportional to temperature because we're at room temperature, probably. Okay, so just for the sake of argument, we'll leave it like that. And then we're just saying that the change in this U, so du dt, is going to be locally generated heat, L, and then minus all this loss off to the sides of the box, right? And so then that's where that divergence comes from. So, yes?
So the heat loss is mm-hmm. the divergence of Q. Is it from heat loss by convection or radiation?
Well, so for now, we're assuming that Q is determined by Fourier's law, so it's a conduction effect. However, like that doesn't necessarily have to be the case in general, right? But I'm just trying to basically, like, what I'm going to do later, as you'll see, is like I'll put the convection and the thermal radiation into L instead of Q. Okay, so then Q is just kind of reserved for conduction in the way that it's formulated. But that's not like the only way you could possibly formulate it. So I hope that makes sense a little bit. Okay, so the point is that if you accept this, and this is actually very similar to what happens with a current as well. So if you're familiar with the conservation of charge, hopefully, then you also probably know that in electronic systems, you can write that the local density of charge d rho dt can be written as kind of like a generation term g, minus the divergence of the current, right? So this is exactly the same principle. So I just wanted to point that out because this will come up in the next lecture too. But hopefully, you know, like these laws are fairly like universal because like there's usually like a relationship between like the partial time derivative and the spatial derivative. And then that's usually called a convective derivative in general. So that's something that you'll see in all kinds of context, that convective derivative. But so if we accept that as given now, and then we just focus on a Q that's determined from Fourier's law, then we can actually substitute into here. And then we can write, I'm going to erase this first. We can write for the, now just the heat capacity problem, du dt is L minus the divergence of this minus K divergence, or sorry, gradient of T, okay? And so then that'll give us L plus K times the Laplacian of T, okay? And now what we can do is, because we said that temperature is proportional to U, now we can actually kind of write everything here in terms of U, assuming that this is constant, okay, just for the sake of argument now. And then this becomes like L plus K Laplacian of U over CV times rho, right? And then we bring this out here. And then this constant K over rho times CV is what we call alpha oftentimes. And so then we get that du dt is going to be L plus alpha times the Laplacian of U. And probably you've seen this equation, du dt is alpha Laplacian of U, and then this L is kind of like an add-in, okay, like if you have thermal loading. And then if you don't, of course, it goes to zero, and then you recover like the most famous like thermal conduction equation. And then that's basically a partial derivative, and this is like a parabolic partial derivative equation, because there's no second derivative in time. Okay. Because remember I said there are three types, like there's parabolic, elliptical, and then hyperbolic. So this is in this class of parabolic. And usually that's thought of as being slightly easier to solve than the other two cases, although I don't claim any of them are particularly easy. This is kind of like bringing us to the point that we're at least starting to think about like partial differential equations in more detail. So that is like, to be honest with you, you could probably teach a whole class or even multiple semesters just on PDEs. Unfortunately, we don't have that much time, but I'll do what I can. Any questions up to now?
Yeah. So also this L is like the source term.
Right.
So if, for example, like if we have a practical problem, we have nanoparticles, mm-hmm. like plasmonic nanoparticles, and we illuminate them with light, mm-hmm. they sort of absorb the radiation.
Right.
Under resonant light absorption.
Right.
And sort of generate heat. So that heat generated would be the L term.
You could say that if L was basically coming from some other aspect of the physics, like an optical absorption, right? Then it would make sense to view that as kind of like an external load because it's not coming there directly through conduction, but it's like the photons arrive and then they get absorbed and then converted into heat. So, yeah, usually anything that's like not conduction physics is quantified by L. At least that's the goal. Now, I mean, it may not always be this straightforward in some situations, especially if you start getting into the quantum regime. Then, like I said before, this is kind of a semi-classical approach to the problem. So there are limits to the applicability of this model, but it's kind of a good starting point to understand heat conduction.
If this particle is in a fluid medium, for example, mm-hmm. so the heat loss like by convection, so we can model that as a boundary condition.
Right. Yeah, and we'll see that soon, I think. So the point is both the convection and the radiation are going to basically be like surface or boundary conditions for this equation, du dt minus L is alpha Laplacian of U. Hopefully that makes sense. Okay. All right, so I haven't even said much about radiative transfer, but like I said, it's when you emit or absorb photons. Okay, so this is perhaps, you know, like one of those things that can be inserted into the L of the previous equation we showed. Okay. Now, the simplest case is just a black body. And as you probably have heard, the rate of emission of just the black body into vacuum is going to be proportional to the fourth power of the temperature. And so this is a famous equation called the Stefan-Boltzmann law, sigma t to the fourth, right? So, I mean, this is kind of significant because this power is much, much larger than anything else we saw before because the other two mechanisms are linear with temperature. Now we have a quartic term. So what that tells us is that this is probably going to be really negligible at low temperatures, but then this could completely dominate the physics at high temperatures. And in fact, like if you think about like interstellar physics, like conduction and convection are virtually ignored in favor of like thermal transport through radiative transfer. Okay. And then another thing that's important to note here is that in a lot of cases, this is not just a one-way street, but you also have photons coming in from the other side. Okay. So if you have like two bodies and then one is at T1 and then one is at T2, then for the sake of simplicity, then we can just assume that each one of these surfaces is infinite and they have some finite gap between them. Okay. And then the point is that this one is going to basically emit an energy or power per unit area that's going to look like sigma T1 to the fourth, whereas this one emits Q of sigma T2 to the fourth. And so as you can imagine, if they start off at different temperatures, then the hotter medium is going to transfer its power over to the lower energy medium. And then they're going to eventually come to thermal equilibrium. Right. So you can still have a thermal equilibrium even in the complete absence of any conduction or convection. And what's interesting about it is, like, the transfer starts off pretty fast because, like, if T1 is much greater than T2, then you have a very, very lopsided one-way transfer of power. But then as they get closer, then that rate will decrease. And then, of course, as you can imagine, since this is like a difference of quartic terms, you can write that also as a difference of squares. So then you can write Q net is equal to sigma T1 squared plus, T2 squared times T1 squared minus T2 squared, right? So you can factor it out like that. And then you can also factor this second term. So then that gives you the sum of squares here, and then the sum of these two temperatures times the difference, T1 minus T2. So you can see that as T1 and T2 get close, then actually this starts to become approximately, like, let's say, some constant of T1 and T2, okay, times delta T. So this actually starts to behave a lot like the other, like Newton's law of cooling and Fourier's law at for small temperature differences, which is kind of interesting, I think. So any questions? Okay. So now I wanted to kind of elaborate on that a little bit and, mention that the first way you can make this more accurate for real materials is include like kind of a spectrally averaged emissivity. So instead of just saying sigma T1 to the fourth, then you'd also have an epsilon 1 here, and then have epsilon 2 here. And then this emissivity value is a number between 0 and 1. And what's interesting is, like, in thermal equilibrium, then this rate of emission is going to be equal to the rate of absorption, okay? Because that's the only way that you can guarantee that two bodies that were emitting with emissivities between 0 and 1 would reach thermal equilibrium, like for all cases, right? And they kind of have to, because if you start off with two bodies that are same temperature and then they develop a temperature difference, then that would violate the second law of thermodynamics. And of course, some people still propose that, but usually wouldn't recommend that for your scientific career. So, so the point is that if you take Kirchhoff's law seriously, now this, of course, is only in thermal equilibrium, so this is not necessarily always true at every moment in time in every single experiment, but certainly in a lot of situations, this is a very, very good approximation. Then you just say that the rate of absorption equals the rate of emission in some sense. And then you basically are able to kind of leverage the spectral dependence that Planck derived for a black body, and then multiply it times like the absorptivity or emissivity of that material at a specific wavelength. Okay, so you may be familiar with this expression, 2 pi hc squared over lambda to the fifth. And then basically, like, some of this is just coming, there's just numerical constants. And then this lambda to the fifth dependence is kind of interesting. So this was originally caused a great deal of consternation, this one over lambda to the fifth term, because it was originally believed that black body radiation would encounter what's called an ultraviolet catastrophe, because, like, there are like a ladder of like higher and higher energy states that can emit like photons. And so then all of the emission of like any kind of black body, even if it's at a relatively modest temperature, would be concentrated in the ultraviolet gamma ray X-ray regime, right? And so, of course, you would have like diverging amounts of emission per unit time, right? Which is totally unphysical and doesn't make any sense. So basically, like, this was the biggest problem in physics, like, at the end of the 19th century. And so then the cure was basically to introduce this so-called occupation factor. And this is now known to be like the bosonic occupation factor. But when Planck first introduced this factor, he didn't actually know exactly what the physical meaning was. He just kind of brought it in empirically to fit the curves that he'd seen. And what this does, like, is basically like if you have something that's like emission as a function of wavelength, okay. So, like I said, as you're going to smaller and smaller wavelengths, you initially start off with this ultraviolet catastrophe. Now, all of the energy, or like I guess we'll say the heat transfer per wavelength, it's all concentrated up here, and then this is just diverging to infinity as lambda goes to zero, right? So that's total disaster. Doesn't make any sense. As you integrate dq d lambda, you then integral, right? Goes to infinity at any non-zero temperature. And that's also obviously very inconsistent with the Stefan-Boltzmann law, to say the least. So once you introduce this occupation factor, now at long wavelengths, this barely does anything. But then at the high wavelengths, it kind of cuts you off so that you have to go back down to exactly zero as you go to infinite frequency or zero wavelength. Okay. So that's basically the physical effect of this. So this is really important, this bosonic occupation factor. And it's now known, like in quantum mechanics, that that factor corresponds to the fact that you don't have any degrees of freedom that are excited at very, very high energies at a small temperature, right? And that the degree of excitation will depend on that temperature in the absence of any like external forcing, right? If it's in thermal equilibrium. And, yeah?
Yeah, I guess it also means that
yeah. Like yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's also being concluded that because like you have very high energy degrees of freedom that are not excited, then that's because of quantization, because you need like a big chunk of energy to cause that excitation. Whereas like the classical picture just said that high energies can still be excited like to a quote unquote modest amount or something, right? So it didn't really like produce like a coherent physical picture that corresponded to reality. And so ultimately like Planck's constant kind of kicked off the era of quantum mechanics, I guess that was around 1897. And then the next century was basically trying to grapple with the implications of that, which are pretty profound, actually. So, any other comments or questions?
Okay. I have a question on what is Jekyll's law.
Uh-huh.
So, the reciprocal of subjectivity is 1 to 1, right?
Here? Yeah, for a black body, epsilon would be 1 for all wavelengths.
Okay, so the absorptivity would be 0 for black body.
No, it's 1. No, black body absorbs all of the light that comes in. That was actually kind of the way it was defined originally.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. So, anyway. So, okay, now the question is, now we've presented all of the physical ideas that we want to model, and then how are we going to do this numerically? Okay, so like I kind of mentioned earlier today, we're going to basically treat both convection and the radiative transfer as boundary conditions on the conduction problem. Okay, so what that means is... Oh, sorry, I meant to say conduction here. But we're going to create a finite element mesh to treat thermal conduction. Okay, sorry, not convection. And then we'll impose the boundary conditions from convection. And so in many problems, that may be enough. Okay, so we may not even have to bring in thermal radiation. But if we do, then optionally we'll include that from disconnected bodies. Now, The challenge here with this last part, however, is that for a lot of geometries, there could potentially be like a lot of interactions that we have to track, right? Because like even if we have this kind of like very large scale thing, okay, and then we grid this with like a bunch of triangles like we've done earlier in the class, right? Now we have to basically track the radiative transfer between all of the triangles on both surfaces, okay? So we have transfer from here to here, of course, and from here to here, but then we also have diagonal, right? So the time that it's gonna take is gonna go like kind of as like the number of surface elements squared, because that's how many we have to treat. In some cases, there may be some symmetries or some other properties that can kind of save us some computation. But this can be a little time consuming in my experience. Like even on a nice computer, it can slow down your simulation quite a bit. Okay, so now with that basic strategy established, then we'll go into kind of the math details. And I think if you guys have seen the website I posted, this step-by-step introduction to thermal transport finite element methods. And it also deals with some mechanical issues, which are treated in a very similar framework. Okay. So, but specifically in chapter 6, if you take a look at it, it kind of sets up this equation, although it never actually writes it exactly in this form, but this is basically what he's getting at, right? So if you remember the equation from before, we said that we have the following, which is du dt is equal to plus this alpha times the velocity of u, okay? And so now what we're trying to do is basically put all of the stuff that's independent of u on the right-hand side, and then represent u as kind of like a temperature field, okay? So that's why it's written in terms of this function t instead of the lowercase u that I'm talking about, right? And then this ct dot basically comes from this expression here, okay? And basically what they do is they start off with that equation here, the du dt, and then impose all those basis function elements. So this so-called ni and nj, right? These are just the basis function elements. And then look at the mutual overlap between these elements. And so basically, like, regardless of the grid dimensionality, there should only be like a small number of off-diagonal elements that overlap with each other. Of course, on-diagonal will always overlap with itself. But if I is not equal to j, then there will only be a small number, right? So this creates like a sparse matrix for us, assuming we made an intelligent choice of basis functions. And then this k plus h t is kind of splitting up this like Laplacian physics into two parts, actually. So the K is really the Laplacian that we're most interested in, right? Because there's like this gradient of both the basis function NJ and then NI. And again, like even after you take the gradient, there should only be a small number of overlaps off diagonal. Okay, and then there's of course this kappa, which is proportional to our alpha. I think the units are just written out a little differently. Okay, because they've multiplied everything by CV in their formulation here. And this HJI is actually like an internal degree of convection. Okay, so like for now, I'm basically ignoring that in like what I'm going to talk about. But of course, you could include this in general. And this is kind of related to what we talked about earlier. So this loading term on the right-hand side can basically come from a number of different sources. And so here, this LQ3J is basically corresponding to the convection on the surface. Okay, so that's the most important thing. And then I think, if I remember correctly, like this was basically like just an internal generation source. This was something like from like a conversion process that was generating heat. I don't remember exactly how he defined this, but this is not limited to this set of variables or sources, right? So anything that could generate heat or remove heat could be potentially put in on this right-hand side. Okay, so you can use your imagination here. But the point is that this is not something that's like a U term. So it doesn't have a U component directly in it, like these terms here, the CT dot MK plus HT. Any questions? Okay. And then the other thing is, like, once you have this formulation, then you can also look at both time-dependent problems and then time-independent problems. If you want the time-independent problems, then basically you're going to just delete this T dot, and then you're going to write K plus HT is equals sum over I Li. And then, like I said, if you want to eliminate that internal convection term, then it just becomes KT equals sum over I Li. So in principle, it looks like a pretty simple linear algebra problem, kind of like we solved at the beginning of the class. So this basically is just kind of showing you some code that was discussed in the book, mainly in chapter 3, but it kind of comes up again in chapters 6 and 7. Okay, and what this code is doing, it's basically like exploiting a toolbox that this author, Peter Crystal, wrote to do thermal FEM. And so here, the first thing is basically setting up the mesh. Okay, so this toolbox basically has like a set of procedures for how to do that mesh. And this is just a 1D mesh at this time. Okay, and then you have both the nodes and then the cells. Okay. So those are the two things that you're constructing. And then here, this was a mechanical set of codes as opposed to the thermal code, but the principle is very similar. And so basically there are a set of inputs that are needed for setting up either type of problem, which includes like the actual material properties, the cells that are set up here from the meshing routine, and then something for integrating, right? Because like a key aspect of what we're trying to do here is to integrate over like the small volumes that we're treating in order to get like the L's correctly, like on those like grid points. And then I don't know what this P is, but it's probably just unchanged for all the simulations. You have to set up the geometry based on this block that you just created. Apply the boundary conditions. Okay, so these are all calling toolbox routines to kind of set up the boundary conditions based on the specific physics of the problem. And here it's like a fairly trivial set of boundary conditions, but you can make it as complicated as you need it to be. And then here is the actual solution where you kind of work through that system of equations that was created from the combination of both the finite element block and the boundary conditions, and then basically solve it, right? So this is amounting to solving the kind of inverse of K times this F, right? And so this is very analogous to K inverse times sum over I of Li. Right. So that's what they're doing right here, like in this last step. Okay. Just basically directly solving the problem. And like I said, this is for the mechanical problem, but the whole setup is almost identical for the thermal problem, but you just have to insert the thermal physics as opposed to mechanical physics. And this is, I think, a static problem. Okay. But you can also potentially do time-dependent problem. But then, of course, that's going to be a little more complicated. So I didn't cover that in detail, but it is in the book. Right. So you can definitely look at it. So this is basically like a steady state solution for a problem where you have like three boundaries that are kind of a fixed temperature. And then there's one boundary that has like this little semicircle of lower temperature or raised temperature. And then kind of looking at what happens inside of the material. This is like a fairly good thermal insulator by assumption, because like it doesn't like just equilibrate to the same temperature everywhere, but you see that there's like a long region in which the temperature gradually ramps down as you get into the bulk of this material. Okay, so that kind of makes sense for an insulator that would do that. But certainly you don't expect copper to do that. So here's another example where basically you've imposed two different temperature surfaces on one end and the other. So this is kind of going back to the problem I mentioned in the beginning of class, where you just have like high temperature here, low temperature here on the wooden table. And then you look at like what is that temperature gradient between the two. And so you see the physics of Fourier's law is such that it doesn't like to see large gradients. So this actually drops down very quickly and then it kind of flattens out. So this is kind of like exponential decay in temperature from one end to the other. So that's kind of like a very generic feature that you would expect to see for thermal conduction. If you didn't see anything like this, then you may have something going wrong, whether it's like the actual setup of the problem or just the numerical technique itself. Okay, and then this is like actually a time-dependent problem, which I thought was pretty cool, showing what happens to temperature in like a shrink wrapping procedure or shrink fitting assembly. And I think the point is that like there are a few different like time snapshots of like the temperature distribution in the shrink fitting assembly, where like if you're familiar with shrink fitting, it's like, you know, when you're wrapping up a piece of software to sell it to somebody, then you just like put this plastic on it and it starts off hot and then it cools off and then stays in place, right? So, I mean, one thing is you don't want it to stay hot forever, because then it would probably melt your software. And then the other thing is you want to have a sense of like what is the temperature distribution over time, so you can kind of, you know, fine tune it to work with the physics or the chemistry of that plastic. And so this is just kind of modeling what happens to both the highest temperature in the system and the lowest temperature in the system. And so obviously, like since the lowest temperature is below 0 Celsius, it's not like at room temperature, but there's either a cooling mechanism or it's just being taken outside on a day like today. And for this high temperature, it's obviously starting off very hot, but it's starting to decay pretty rapidly. So within 12 seconds, you've already seen a substantial reduction in the hot temperature. So you can also do like both like a steady state solution as well as like this time dependent problem, where you kind of provide this initial impulse of thermal energy and then just like kind of let it go to this, I guess, presumably steady state temperature minus 10 Celsius. And then that can also tell you like what kind of cooling you need if you have a certain like heat input in order to get it to the target and the target time and so on. So that's very helpful if you're trying to do any engineering problems, right? To understand the time dependence. And I mean, there are like very simple heuristics you can use to kind of estimate like the time of decay, like the heat capacity of the body and like the initial thermal energy and final thermal energy kind of gives you like a key time scale. But this is obviously a much more detailed look at the problem, and it can account for any like inhomogeneities that may occur. And then finally, I wanted to show you what errors are observed in these kind of simulations as a function of the mesh size, right? And so basically on the right-hand side, it's a very coarse mesh, and so you expect the errors are going to be relatively large. And here it looks like errors based on what type of element you're using, whether it's T3 or a linear finite element, or T6, which is a quadratic finite element, then it's somewhere between like 0.2 to 0.4, 0.5%. Okay, so that's not necessarily that great for a lot of simulations, but then you can kind of rapidly reduce it, and it looks like it's more or less quadratic for both, but the linear element is not like as well behaved as you go to these like lower mesh sizes. So it's still helpful to go to lower mesh size in general, but actually you have to be a little careful with these linear elements in terms of the errors. So it's always good to kind of track these sort of things in practice, I think. Hopefully that kind of made sense. And next time we're going to talk about electronic transport. And also just a reminder that I did get a lot of your homeworks, but if you didn't send it to me, just please send it to me today. Thanks.